Hello and welcome to the program.
Tonight, the historic wildfires raging in Australia, taking a devastating toll on many of its most famous citizens. You can hear this koala's haunting screams.
Approximately 13 billion acres of land have burned in
Australia's
wildfires.
Hello
and welcome to the program. Along with the tragic loss of human life, millions of animals have perished. Today, we ask what can be done to help the people and the wildlife. Errol Fuller, World Authority on Animal Extinction, joins us with his new book, celebrating the majestic elephant and lamenting its future. And Terry Flanagan has more news on the year-long biodiversity audit happening at Áras an Uachtaráin.
The openness of the woodland have delighted me, actually. Most of the woodlands we're familiar with in Ireland are plantation woodlands, and they're close and they're dark, but here's a woodland that's well spaced. There's grass growing among the trees. There's a very wide variety of trees. The ground is obviously ungrazed and undisturbed, and most of it is unfertilized. All pluses for fungi.
Yes, indeed, a very busy programme ahead of us today. Dr. Richard Collins is in studio along with Aina Nilana. Aina, you were mentioning last week the corncrake when you were studying at UCD, were you not?
I was indeed, and we used to hear it as we walked down through the Clonsky entrance. That would be, let me see, 1969, 1970, because that was when I was in...
God, was I even born then, I wonder?
Anyway, you were two or something.
Anyway, we got an email in. It said, hello, I did my Leaving Cert in 1969. There you go. All night long, the corncrake craked as I desperately tried to cram. They nested in the fields behind the house, known as Fendara. It is still there. My mother used to say we lived 4 miles from Nelson's Pillar. For the next few years, too, as I studied at college, they were my nighttime companions. Love your programme. And apparently, Fendara is somewhere around Mount Anvil in Dublin, which isn't a million miles away from
UCD. It's just
UCD.
Down the other end of the big long road that connects the two, and obviously round Mount Anvil. And even to this day, there's a lot of open space still there. So the corncrakes were presumably breeding in this part of South Dublin in the late 1960s, early 1970s.
More confirmation, if it were needed.
Well, did you doubt me in the first place?
No, I didn't, but that was from Bernard, and he just happened to add that in. Anyway, this sound you'll all be familiar with. The trumpeting sound of an elephant. Elephants are among the most intelligent and beloved of all creatures. Across the centuries, they've become embedded in the culture and folklore of countries around the world. And as they've continued to capture the public imagination, their unique place in art and literature has been assured. Elephants, I'm sure you know, are the world's largest land animal, with male African elephants standing up to a staggering 13 feet tall or 4 metres in today's money. Socially, they are human-like in terms of planning, interaction and gestures. And unlike most animals, they can recognise themselves in a mirror. We'll discover how later on. And can also identify more than 100 other individuals. They also have great memories for bearing grudges and are known to exact revenge against cruel keepers after surprisingly long periods of apparent submissiveness. A new beautifully illustrated book looks into the mysteries and contradictions of these magnificent beasts. It is by artist, writer and extinction expert Errol Fuller and is simply entitled Elephant. Errol joins us now from the BBC studios in Tunbridge Wells. Hello, Errol. Nice to speak with you again. Let's go back to the beginning. Where did it all start for the elephant?
The elephant has a long, long evolutionary history. Its closest relatives today are little creatures that you would never imagine were related to it. That it's something called a hyrax that lives in Africa and is, well, it looks a bit like a gigantic rat, but it's only about 2 feet long. People often think that the elephant might be related to the hippopotamus or the rhinoceros, but it's not. It comes from a completely different evolutionary line.
And what's the line it comes from? And why does the elephant look as it does? And the hyrax, is that what you said? Look like it does, like a little rat. Well, why do they look so different if they're related?
They're related very, very distantly. I'm giving you a bit of a misconception here. The elephant comes from a long line of creatures that originally looked a little bit like pigs. They're not related to pigs, but they look a little bit like pigs. And then it gradually developed, and there are many species that have evolved over millions of years. And gradually they developed to look a little bit like the things that we know today. And that process increased and increased and increased until you got things like mastodons and mammoths that look very much like today's elephants. Then we're left with just the Indian elephant, the Asian elephant, I should say, mm-hmm. and the African elephant. That's all that remains of this great lineage of elephant species that once lived on this planet.
Why did it evolve from looking something like a pig, which presumably had a tiny tail and a snout, to this animal that was this huge creature weighing tons with a long snout and big ears?
The truth is, we don't really know. I mean, it probably became enormous as much for defensive reasons as anything else. I mean, something as big as an elephant has comparatively few actual enemies. All right, it can be preyed upon when it's young, but once it reaches maturity, it's fairly safe. So probably the size has something to do with that, because size has its own problems. I mean, if you're as big as an elephant, you require tons and tons of food over a lifetime. Mm. So you've got to find the food. So size creates its own problem. We don't really know, other than the reason I've just said, why they developed size. And similarly, the trunk. The trunk is a very interesting thing, because an elephant can do all manner of things with its trunk, and it protects its trunk very cautiously. This appendage is of vital importance to the animal. In fact, I think, in a way, it compares to our hands, human hands, because obviously elephant have got these great big clumping feet, so there's no way that there's anything like a hand, whereas a trunk in many ways serves as a hand.
Yes, it's used for grasping, for pulling, and for slapping.
It can do all manner of things with it, and as I say, it's very protective towards it. People think that maybe that's why elephants are traditionally supposed to be afraid of mice. I don't really think they are, but there's...
Well, because the mouse might run up its trunk?
Exactly.
Really?
And they're certainly very frightened of bees.
Well,
only place a bee could hurt an elephant is on the tip of its trunk.
Could be stung in the eyes as well, too.
But that's correct.
Is the essence of elephant a trunk? Mastodons and the mammoths had trunks. And in fact, the mammoths were contemporaneous with humans.
The mastodons weren't, but the mammoths were.
And we have pictures of them.
One interesting thing about the mammoths is that it's been found that they survived on a little island in the Bering Straits between Alaska and Siberia until 4,000 years ago. There were mammoths roaming the earth when the Egyptians were building the pyramids.
And it was the warming up of the globe, I suppose, and the removal of all that tundra and grazing areas that caused it to become extinct. Or was it human hunting?
I think human hunting had a great deal to do with it. And climate change also probably had a great deal to do with it, because what people forget is that the world has been warming up and cooling down for thousands and thousands of years. I mean, for instance, the ice sheets 20,000 years ago reached down almost to the Mediterranean. And then within a few thousand years, they went back to more or less where they are today. These processes have been happening in the past. Maybe we're accelerating them now by our
activities. Well, we surely are, because in 200 years we've gone to the stage of practically melting all the ice in the Arctic. It took 2,000 years, you said, for the ice to retreat. So the change that's happening nowadays is happening at a much faster rate because of the amount of carbon we put into the atmosphere. Well, we mustn't let people think that this is a natural process. It surely is not.
The change that's happening certainly is rapid at the moment, but what I'm saying is it has been rapid in the past. I believe, as you do, that our use of so many different materials and chopping down the rainforests and things of that kind is certainly increasing the rate at which the world is warming up. There's very little doubt about that.
Jambo, Earl, I've learned that word from your book. It's Swahili for hello.
Yes.
And of course, that's where the name Jumbo comes from. So I'd be tempted to say Jumbo to everyone from now on.
Yeah, Jumbo. Yeah, it's the same word.
We must have been involved in the demise of the poor elephant. The elephant was in the south of France, what is now the south of France. There's a cave in the Dordogne which has over 100 mammoth illustrations. Elephants, yeah. And the mammoth is very close to the Asiatic elephant, and there are attempts to breed it back, whether that will succeed or not. This is a wonderful book. It seems to me all elephant life, the News of the World used to have a caption, all human life is there. Do you remember the News of the World?
Yeah,
Christine Keeler and all that big scandal back in the early 60s. Now, in your book, all elephant life is there. It's very comprehensive. It's very holistic. It includes everything. The history, the nature of the elephants, the various kinds of elephant, and their evolution. And an extraordinary amount of wonderful stories about elephants in culture, things that happened and strayed. This is a very important animal. It's a kind of cultural icon, really, you know.
Well, it absolutely is. And the reason, or one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is there are hundreds of books on elephants, but they all seem to be on the idea of my 12 years with elephants in Botswana, or my 6 months spent in some nature reserve somewhere in Africa. As far as I know, and I might be wrong about this, there is no book that actually tells the story of the elephant in its entirety. Like my book has chapters on the African elephant, the Asian elephant, the elephant in prehistory, elephant curiosities, like the fact that they paint these weird pictures, the elephant in art and literature, ivory, of course, because that's very important, and conservation. There doesn't seem to be another book that actually tells the whole story, and I wanted to do that.
Can I ask you, you have a wonderful collection in your home in Tonbridge Wells. I was privileged to visit you on two occasions and see this wonderful thing.
I remember.
Now, there are these pictures that elephants draw. I'm sure you must have one. I didn't see one when we were there.
No.
But in the ones illustrated in your book are quite remarkable, the elephant self-portraits and things.
I have got one, not a very good one, but I have got one. It's a remarkable thing. And various people say it's just a trick because the owner of the elephant stands next to the elephant, provides him with the paint and the canvas and tweaks his ear and things from time to time. And people say, well, he's just telling the elephant what to do. The elephant then produces this picture of a flower, a tree, or another elephant's head. And that picture looks just as if a 7-year-old child had done it. Now, obviously, the elephant wouldn't do the picture unless the materials were given to it. But it's still remarkable that it can actually draw something that you and I will recognize for what it is.
And do you think that he's trained, he's sort of trained like a circus trick to draw a flower? And when he gets it right, he gets a reward. When he doesn't, he gets a prod in his backside or something.
I think that's certainly true. But that's what we do with 5-year-old children. We train them. You know, if a child draws a house and hasn't put a front door in, we tell it to put the front door in. Hasn't put a knocker on the front door, we tell it to put a knocker on the front door. So if they're trained to do it, it's just the same as, it seems to me, as we would teach a child to do something. And I think this is kind of an example of just how clever these creatures are.
Can we go back to talking about the African elephant and the Asian elephant? Because genetically, there's 4% difference between them. So they're completely different species. You need to be 1% different to be a different species. So even though they look very similar, they actually are 4% different. Now, one lot are now in India and one lot are in Africa. But India was way back before, you know, in continental drift and all of that, was actually the other side of the equator down beside Africa. And in fact, all the elephants, all those very early elephants were the same. And the Indian elephants then evolved as Asia, as India moved right up to crash into the Himalayas all those millions of years ago and never saw the African elephants again. But they did originate from the one pre-elephant, if you like, that was presumably a continuation of the mammoths. Or the
almost certainly they did.
Yeah. So then we end up then being able to see these Indian elephants used quite a bit to do work, and you see pictures of them carrying logs and being working for farmers, and not so in Africa. And you draw the point that this is actually because the people in India train their elephants and the people in Africa don't, not because the African elephants are intractable, that they would be trained.
That's absolutely
indeed.
Right. And I mean, the feeling is, and I used to believe this, that the African elephant was intractable and couldn't be trained. But when I looked into it, I discovered there are many examples of African elephants being trained. So I think this was the training aspect was kind of a human cultural thing, that the humans in Africa didn't see any point or didn't dare try to train the elephants, whereas the Asian peoples did.
I think that's down to violence or aggression. I remember talking to zookeepers about it. If you go to zoos, you find predominantly it's Asian elephants they have.
Yes,
seldom do you find, you do sometimes find African elephants in zoos. And the suggestion was that it's much more difficult with them. They're more bulky and they're aggressive and unpredictable and dangerous.
Well,
is this true?
There is no doubt that the male African elephant is a dangerous beast. And they have, African elephants have a slightly different social structure to Indian elephants. And a rogue male, African elephant, can be highly dangerous. And they have something called mushed, which is a period when they become sexually very driven. And the male elephant then is real trouble to other elephants and to anything that it comes across. So, yes, you're right. African elephants are probably more hostile, if we want to use that word.
So this doesn't happen to the Asian elephants?
It does happen. It does happen, yes. I don't think it's quite as marked. But some Indian elephants can be very dangerous. The elephant, when it's in the wrong mood, is a dangerous creature. It can be tamed in all the ways we know. But there are examples, and I'm quite glad there are, to be quite honest, of elephants actually turning on cruel trainers. There's one really interesting story in my book about an elephant that was beaten over the head with a coconut, and the coconut shattered into loads of bits. The man that done it left the enclosure where the elephant was, and the elephant gathered up all the bits and kept them between his legs and wouldn't let anyone come near them. Then when the owner or the keeper came back into the enclosure 3 days later, the elephant immediately charged him, trampled him, killed him, and then went back to his pile of coconut pieces and one by one lifted them with his trunk and carried them to where the dead body was and dropped the pieces on the dead man.
Yeah, that'll learn them, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's revenge symbolised, isn't it?
I wanted to ask you about the amount of food that they eat, because really the awful conclusion I come to from your book is that elephants nowadays are on a hiding to nothing because the population of the world has increased enormously.
I think of
them in Africa, a great wild continent with fewer people, lots of wild places, because African elephants, you know, have to eat so many kilograms of vegetation every single day that if there's crops, if there's people living there, they just are completely at odds with each other. Maybe you might like to tell us a bit more about that.
This is the real problem for elephants. Let's just talk about Africa for a moment. It applies as well to Asia, but Africa, there are far more people in Africa now than there were, say, 50 years ago. And the big problem for elephants isn't ivory poaching. Ivory poaching is a horrible, horrible thing, and I'm not wishing to downplay that in any way. It's disgusting. But in terms of the numbers of elephants that are killed, probably ivory poaching doesn't represent that many statistically. What represents the statistical decline of the elephant is the use by man of more and more land. So there's fewer and fewer places for elephants to go. And as you just suggested, elephants need vast areas just to sustain themselves with food and things. And they don't have any rules or laws. They will go wherever they want. So they will trample out crops and things that people have planted. They'll destroy villages, not deliberately, just passing through. And so local people often don't want them. I quoted something in the book, an African president, I can't remember who it was, said, "I'm always asked for more schools, for more hospitals, for more this, for more that. I'm never asked for more elephants." And I think that sums up the problem, that there are fewer and fewer places for elephants to go. And that is the real problem with elephant decline. And the elephant is declining at a rate that is much faster than people think. And people think, oh, it's to do with ivory poaching. Well, that's a nasty, horrible thing, but that's not the real main cause of elephant decline. It's a loss of habitat and the fact that to local people, elephants are a great nuisance.
One thing you don't talk about and is the problem that has been encountered in Kruger, and that is that there are too many elephants and there is nothing killing the elephants from the top. Elephants are bulldozers, they're tanks. Yeah. They knock over trees to get at the branches,
absolutely.
Unlike the giraffe who stretches up and gets the leaves that way. At the end of the day, they are kind of their own worst enemy because they annihilate the very plants on which they depend.
That's
now,
right.
And there were there has been talk, I don't know if it was ever implemented, of shooting as a proportion of the elephants in places like Kruger to keep them within reasonable limits. Can you tell us a little about that problem?
Well, culling is something that I'm afraid, being realistic, has to happen in various places. And the problem there is, once again, lack of space. 100 years ago, there were vast tracts of land for elephants to roam over. So if they pulled trees up, if they destroyed areas, it didn't really matter in the great scheme of things because there was many other places for them to go. But now, with human encroachment onto the kind of land that elephants once roamed over, those places are getting fewer and fewer and smaller and smaller. And that is the essence of the problem. Now, culling is a pretty horrible thing, but I'm sure it has to happen in some places just because it has to happen. We've either got people or we've got elephants.
How do they manage in India, where the population is 1 billion? I mean, the density of people there must be greater than they are in Africa.
Well, again, the actual wild Asian elephant is as much under threat as the African elephant. People don't really talk about it. People talk about the African elephant. But the wild Indian elephant is absolutely under threat. And the domesticated elephants obviously carry on with their lives, and that's okay, apart from the fact that they're very badly treated, many of them, horribly treated. But people tend not to talk about the problem of the Asian elephant. I don't know quite why, but they don't. Just like people don't really talk about the problem of Asian rhinos, but they talk all the time about African rhinos. I think it's because we have this idea of hunting and we see these images of a rhino being shot or an elephant being shot. So that gets into our brains, but we don't see the pictures of maltreatment of Asian elephant is in as much trouble as the African elephant.
The Asian elephant, I mean, there aren't very many wild spaces there at all for them. And then most of the wild rainforest in those areas is in reserves. There's hardly any stuff that isn't.
Well, there you are. You've just hit the nail on the head.
Well, no, it's not as bad as all that. I remember in India going out on elephants in the early morning with the mahout. And he would take this out this is in Corbett Park in the north of India. And the elephant would proceed out, and eventually we encountered a large herd of wild Asian elephants. And they completely accepted us. And here we were in the midst of this herd with wild animals all around us, peacefully grazing away, you know. It was quite remarkable. And, of course, there was huge areas in these parks. I would have thought the problem is mainly islandization because there's no connection between them. There are huge parks in various places in India, but they are all far from each other and there is no way that the gene pool can be replenished.
Idea of an island, that there's no connection with the next island, which might be 500,000 miles away, is a very important one. And a man called David Quammen wrote a book called The Song of the Dodo, which wasn't actually about dodos, but about absolutely that point that you're making, that when animal populations get separated from each other, the consequences can be completely untold. We don't know what will happen.
Like the pandas in China.
Yeah.
But are white elephants only Asian elephants?
White elephants?
Are only Asian ones, are they? There's no African white elephants.
I think there probably are.
But the whole story of the white elephant refers to the Asian ones.
Yeah, well, that's really because in Asia, a white elephant in various ways was treasured or became the property of the local ruler. And so the whole kind of stories grew up about white elephants. Was that didn't happen in Africa. But I mean, there will be albino elephants. The thing about albinos or white animals is they don't usually survive to adulthood for all the natural pressures that are on them. So when they do, those rare occasions they do, they are highly prized. But in Africa, I don't think anyone really bothered. I mean, we've already said about how they are more difficult to train, or that's never been the culture. So there was no real reason to keep a white elephant, whereas in Asia there was.
It was a punishment. If you offended the ruler, he would present you with a white elephant.
That's where the expression white elephant comes from.
And this was a great honour on paper. But you couldn't exploit a wild elephant. You couldn't make the wild elephant work. You had to, albino, part albino, leucistic elephant. Now, so what you had to do was look after it and pamper it, which cost you a fortune. It ate you out of house and home, which was ostensibly a gift, was in fact a punishment.
Exactly.
It's a wonderful thing. There is another elephant we haven't mentioned, and that is the forest elephant. Now, there's been a controversy about this all along. Is it to be regarded as a separate species of elephant, a third species of elephant, or should we just simply say it's a subspecies of one of them?
My own feeling is it's a subspecies, but this whole species discussion depends on how you define species.
What's a forest elephant? Tell us.
It's a smaller elephant that lives deep in the forest and will vanish very quickly into the forest, even if you happen on one.
They both in Asia and in Africa?
There are ones in Asia, yes, but the one that we're talking about really is the African one. We used to sort of images of elephants in the Great Plains or on the savannas, whereas these forest elephants are much more secretive, and there are far fewer images of them because they're so difficult to see. There's this great discussion about whether they're a separate species or not. But as I said, that depends how you define species. I mean, I'm sure, for instance, that although the African elephant is a different species to the Asian elephant, if they are put together, they will breed, just like lions and tigers will breed if they're put in captivity together. So different species, this is an area that people don't really talk about very much. Hybridization, lots of things that we regard as different species will actually interbreed. And I'm sure the forest elephant would interbreed with the elephants that don't live in forests.
Errol, I'm told that Aristotle said this beast passes all others in wit and wisdom. In what way do they resemble humans?
They resemble humans in many ways. I mean, they grieve, for instance. They seem to have some sort of social responsibility. They look after their young. They recognize one another. An elephant can recognize several hundred individuals, different from this one and that one. They have tremendously long memories. They often have an intelligent approach to problems. They are very like us. And in fact, I have this idea that if elephants had hands instead of those clumping feet, who knows, they may be the rulers of the earth. They have perceptions that most animals don't have. I mean, the idea that they can recognize themselves as an individual in a mirror, and that's been tested in various ways, they can. They know that that is them in the same way as you know that's me when you look in the mirror.
You better explain that, Errol, because you discussed it with myself and Richard some time ago, but it's probably best to explain how they identify themselves in the mirror for the benefit of the listeners.
People have painted a red spot on their forehead, and the elephant will look in the mirror, it will see the red spot, and it will move its trunk up to try and remove it. Now, most animals do not recognize themselves in mirrors. If you think of, say, a dog will either ignore the reflection in a mirror, or sometimes it might bark at it because it thinks it's another dog. Most mammals do not recognize themselves in mirrors.
I see that with birds all the time. They'll attack their own image in a glass reflection. But you mentioned earlier revenge and how the elephant got revenge on its nasty keeper.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you about your own memory and Aina's memory and Richard's memory and everybody else listening. How is your elephant memory? Can I take you back to the 1990s? Because this is a story of sweet revenge. You may remember an ad for Rolo. You know, you give everybody your last Rolo. We'll play it for you, but it's very visual, this one. But I'll explain it to you first, and then we'll play it to you, and then you'll hear it, and then you'll get it. The story is this young boy who tempts a baby elephant with a Rolo and then snatches it away into his mouth and taunts the elephant. And then years later, we meet the pair again as adults, and the elephant taps the man on the shoulder and thwacks him across the face with his trunk. Have a listen.
Huh? Hey, Dumbo! Nana! Nah, 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 nah.
It was worth buying a Rolo just for that. Fantastic. Well, you've
got a better memory than me because I don't remember that advert.
Do you not remember that ad?
No.
I can't remember if you've got a TV in your house.
Oh, no, I have, definitely. I watch the TV all the time.
Well, Errol, it's a great read. Thank you so much for talking to us today. We really do appreciate it. And you can find details on our website of Errol's book, which is simply titled Elephant. Richard, you want to say something?
Yes, I think the book would make an excellent television series or even a programme, but it's a good template for that. Any hope of that, Errol?
None that I know of. I'd be very happy to participate in such an endeavour, but yeah.
Well, Errol, thank you very much indeed. Very much appreciated. Thank you. Talk to you again soon.
Yeah, I'll look forward to it.
Well, for months now, the increasingly destructive impact of wildfires sweeping through Australia has been making global news.
Tonight, the historic wildfires raging in Australia, taking a devastating toll on many of its most famous citizens. You can hear this koala's haunting screams. Good Samaritans rushing into the smouldering brush, rescuing the singed and stunned marsupials.
I knew if we didn't get him down from the tree, then he would have been up there amongst the flames.
Now, a desperate fight to nurse the injured survivors back to health.
He's got a long road in front of him if he can survive.
Tonight, donations are pouring in from around the world to help those...
Since July of last year, large swathes of the country have been destroyed and the worst fires seen in decades. There have been fires in every Australian state, with New South Wales being the hardest hit. The human death toll has risen to over 30 and more than 2,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged. As firefighters continue to struggle to contain the massive blazes, the cost to wildlife and the natural world is also being counted. Australia is one of the great biodiversity spots in the world. The continent was isolated for millions of years, allowing species to evolve in unique ways, with minimal human influence until relatively recently. Before the fires, its diversity was already threatened due to invasive species, habitat destruction and climate change. Now, ecologists fear severe ecological consequences from so much land being burned at once. What you're listening to is the mating call of a koala on Kangaroo Island, up to half of which has been on fire. We're joined now on the line from Queensland by Gabriel Crowley of the Centre of Biodiversity and Conservation Science at the University of Queensland in Brisbane. Gabriel has been studying the impact of the fires on Kangaroo Island. I suppose before we start, Gabriel, we should really remember the tragic loss of human life in these fires.
Yes, there's a lot of people who are really putting their life on the line, helping fight these fires. I believe now that the three people who died in that plane crash were among 30 or more people who have been killed in the fires so far this year. Very unexpected. The people who fly those planes are professionals. They do an amazing job, and it just shows what difficult circumstances that they're operating under.
Gabriel, these bushfires are regarded by the fire services as the worst bushfire season in memory. Can you describe just how devastating the scene has been?
There's been fires and quite severe fires in Australia as long as we know, but they've never been so widespread, and they've never started so early and had such a long fire season. We're not even through the fire season yet. We've got really another 2 months to go. Where the fires have burnt, they've often left nothing more than charred trunks. The ground just is a wasteland between them. You've probably seen footage of these fires in Ireland. I know they've been broadcast around the world. It really is quite devastating, and in places there is just nothing left living.
Well, you're studying the impact, as I said, of the fires on Kangaroo Island. I've been there myself many years ago, and beautiful island it is, and one of the only places in the world where I think you can find the echidna and the duck-billed platypus in one place. What impact is it having on the animals of Kangaroo Island, and in particular on the koala population?
The fires have burnt half of the island, and most of that is in the native bushland. So, of course, that's where most of the wildlife live. The koala population in particular has been reduced enormously. Well over half the population of koalas on the island have lost their habitat, and many of those will have been killed.
And apart from the ones that have been killed, the ones left behind fare no better, as we heard in that report, horrendous burns.
That's right. They've set up clinics to look after them, and they're, as well as the professional wildlife people on the island, I know there are lots of volunteers and even members of the army going and helping to nurse those koalas, and some of the burns are quite horrendous.
These koalas were introduced to Kangaroo Island for a particular reason, because there's a disease among the koalas in Australia in general, chlamydia, which is a debilitating disease. But the ones that were brought then to Kangaroo Island were disease-free. And now they're the only disease-free ones that are in Australia, and half of them have been killed by these terrible fires. So it's a double whammy. It's not so much that koalas are extinct in the whole of Australia or under threat. It's that these disease-free ones that you were specially minding and breeding for this purpose, or having a habitat for them, that this has been destroyed.
That's right. The original population that was brought to Kangaroo Island was actually from a small population that had been introduced to another island, French Island in Victoria, and then 17 koalas were taken from French Island onto Kangaroo Island. Both islands have been affected by widespread bushfires, and both islands, I believe, are free of the disease. The populations of koalas on these two islands really have been seen as very important for their conservation.
But you're also concerned about the Dunart and the glossy black cockatoo. Can you outline your concerns?
The glossy black cockatoo is a large black cockatoo. It's a beautiful bird, very charismatic. It stands about 40 centimetres high, and there are glossy black cockatoos through eastern Australia, but the subspecies on Kangaroo Island is not found anywhere else. It used to be on the mainland, but with all the vegetation clearance on the mainland, it is now only found on Kangaroo Island. It's very unique because it's one of the few species of birds that only feeds on a single food source, which is the seed of the drooping sheoak. And because of feeding on this food source, it's really tied to its habitat.
Of course.
And also the food source isn't as energy rich as some other food sources that cockatoos feed on. So it only lays one egg, and once it raises a chick, it is generally at least 2 years before it can get enough food and energy to raise a second one. So it breeds very, very slowly, and when its population is hit by something like the bushfires, it has a very slow capacity to recover.
We've heard that more than a billion animals may have perished in these fires. Now, at this point, what's your assessment as to which species may be driven to extinction by the fires?
I work on individual species, and it's been hard to keep track of all the information coming out. We're certainly worried about species that have very small distributions or have specific habitat requirements in the forested areas, because it's largely been moist forests that have been burnt in these fires. On Kangaroo Island, there are many species that will be affected, but the species that you mentioned, the Kangaroo Island dunart, which is a small marsupial carnivore, and the glossy black cockatoo, their distributions are very restricted and have largely been burnt. So it's those types of species that are very restricted in distribution and habitat use that we are most worried about.
Gabriel, fires are normal in Australia, forest fires. They're strange things to us because we don't have forest fires. But when we think of Australia, we have to realise that this is part of the ecosystem in a way. Now, you have these countless animals there for millennia. They must surely have evolved defences against this kind of thing, ways they can cope, things they can do when they see smoke in the distance or whatever. You take the famous tsunami, St. Stephen's Day tsunami, it killed a great many people, but wildlife managed to evade it almost completely, or so they tell us, because the wildlife was geared to deal with this kind of disaster. Why is it that Australian wildlife doesn't seem to be able to deal with this disaster?
We've just never had fires that are so extensive. So a lot of the species that are adapted to fire will shelter in areas that escape burning, small patches of vegetation that might be along a stream side or just in an area where the fuel load wasn't very high. So in most cases, these types of species will hang on in very small areas and then breed up and recolonise the unburnt areas as those areas regrow. But when you get really widespread fires that are so severe, there just aren't the places for them to hide in, to recover. Now, we have been lucky with the dunart, partly because where the fire started was actually right inside an area of dunart habitat. So when the fire started there, it hadn't built up to a high intensity. It was quite patchy, and they have now found dunarts in that area, in the pieces of bush that have managed to hang on. And, of course, the glossy black cockatoos could fly away. So we're hopeful that those animals will survive the fire. What might be more difficult, particularly for the cockatoo, is finding food with so much of their habitat being destroyed.
When it's all over, if it is ever all over, I mean, is there any expectation that these fires will stop soon? And then when they do stop, how long will it take for the habitats to regenerate?
Well, our typical fire season really is February and March. So we could have another 2 months of these conditions. And we've been having, right down the east coast of Australia, we've been having very severe thunderstorms. So if we keep having these conditions, we will have more fires. For the habitat to recover enough to support the animals again will depend on the species. So with the dunart, it could be quite quick. It could be within a couple of years, because the glossy black cockatoo feeds on seeds from mature trees, it could take a decade. And that's got to be a decade in which we don't have a repeat of these extreme fire conditions.
Before we finish, I want to take you back to the beginning. I said that I had been on Kangaroo Island and I remembered a poem I learned when I was going out there for the programme we were making by a humorist and a poet by the name of Ogden Nash. And he said, "I like the duck-billed platypus because it is anomalous. I like the way it raises its family, partly birdly, partly mammally." And I'm sure most of us have seen pictures of a duck-billed platypus. If you haven't, look them up online, show them to the kids. They're extraordinary looking creatures. They really are. Along with the echidna, which I had mentioned earlier. What I'm wondering, Gabriel, is how are they going to manage in these fires?
It's quite hard to know because getting out to the areas where the platypus live is quite dangerous. Those areas have not been surveyed yet. But as they live in riverbanks and can hide down burrows, they're unlikely to have been badly affected. What's more likely to be a problem is the drought conditions that will have dried up quite a few of those water holes. But I'd be quite hopeful that the platypus on Kangaroo Island will not be too badly affected. In other areas, we really are worried about the pollution of the waterways, which is occurring with the heavy rain following the fires, with a lot of soil and ash washing into the waterways. And that's particularly the case in the steep catchments of the eastern coast of Australia.
And the echidna, this creature which looks like a hedgehog but isn't. I mean, you could be driving along the road around Kangaroo Island, this thing just appears in front of you. It's a very large creature.
Yes, echidnas will burrow down into the ground. And there have been reports of singed spines on the echidnas. But again, if the fire is very intense, it would be very hard for them to escape. It's going to be over the next 12 months, we'll have to get out there and survey these areas and just do an assessment of what has been affected. And certainly the estimates of over a billion animals Australia-wide being killed is very alarming, but more alarming in some ways is the fact that the ones that have survived might not have habitat to live in really for the next couple of years at least.
Well, Gabriel, our thoughts are with you and the people of Australia. So thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak with us today. You can find more information on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Now, if you were listening to last week's Mooney Goes Wild, you'll have heard Terry Flanagan's report from Áras an Uachtaráin, where President Michael D. Higgins is currently welcoming a team of ecologists from Trinity College Dublin. They're conducting a detailed year-long biodiversity audit of the 130-acre grounds with a view to protecting this natural environment both now and into the future. Over the next 12 months, the ecology team will quantify both habitat and species diversity on the site, which features formal and certified organic kitchen gardens, grasslands, wooded areas, and a lake. On board for this project are plant, fungi, insect, bird, mammal, reptile, and amphibian experts. This week, Professor Paul Dowding, mycologist and lecturer in botany at Trinity College Dublin, has been speaking with Terry Flanagan at the Áras.
Fantastic ring. My God, I've never seen a ring as big as that before.
No, it's big fungi too.
What species is this?
It doesn't have an English name. It's a funnel cap, that's a general name for this genus. It's Clytosibi geotropa.
Right, that's a mouthful.
Yes, absolutely. Not as bad as some of them.
What does it mean?
Clytosibi is a funnel cap,
right?
Literally. Geotropa, growing on the ground.
Okay, well, can I pick one?
Yeah, you can.
Okay. They're very large. They're like almost the size of a dinner plate, and they're very, very rubbery.
They're rubbery now. They were firmer when they were young, and I've never eaten them before finding them in the Áras, and I've had four good meals out of them from the two previous collections.
You weren't worried about eating them, no?
Well, I'd identified it positively.
Yeah. Now, I know you are a professor of mycology, so I don't mean that in a bad way.
No.
But most people are very, very wary of
eating.
Well,
they should be.
Yeah.
Because even today I picked up two species that are sort of mauve and look rather similar, but one belongs to a poisonous genus and the other is perfectly edible.
Right. Now, I've never seen this growing in such large numbers as I see here in the Auras. Is
Neither
there any reason for that?
I haven't either. I think it's because this ground is undisturbed in the sense it's not fertilised, it's mowed, but there's lots of leaves falling on it, it's not grazed, there aren't deer here. So long-lived things like this can develop.
Mm-hmm. Now, just to say where we are, we're on the actual driveway, the main driveway from the entrance right up to the house. We're only about 100 metres or so from the entrance. So not much traffic here, either human or animal.
No. And I've found these all over the Arras. Mm-hmm. You can go to the far end of the Arras and there's some growing there as well.
Right. Your role here is to come in and to study the fungi that are here, the different species, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And what have you found so far?
I found, apart from today's catch, 79 species of fungi.
That seems quite a lot.
It's quite a lot, but we have to wait until the plant people do their work, because the mycologists, the professionals, reckon you should find 6 species of fungi for every 1 species of plant.
Right, give us a little look in the bag. Let's see what you have here.
Here we go. It looks like a mess of mushrooms, which it is, but it's very important if you're collecting mushrooms to collect in something rigid, because if you put them in a poly bag, they all squidge together.
Yeah. There's a beautiful purple one there.
Yeah, the purple, well, 2 purple ones. Here. Yeah, I'll take it out. There are 2 purple ones. There's a fat, lumpy one, which is very, very vigorous, with a brownish cap, very fat stem. And there's a much more delicate one.
That's very pretty, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a very pretty colour.
Absolutely. Wonderful colour underneath. And they both got gills. They both got purple gills. This, in my left hand, belongs to a poisonous genus. Wouldn't eat any of them. And this is a bluet, B-L-E-W-I-T, which is perfectly edible. So this just illustrates, you have to be very careful about what you eat. There are a number of characters between these two, now I've got them in my hand, that are very different. So when you've got the poisonous one and the edible one in your hands, it's easier to see the difference. But if you've only got one of them, You can't compare. Yeah. No.
What else have you got there in the bag? How many species do you think you have in there?
Probably about 30, but I've had some of them before. This is a black jelly fungus that grows on...
Now, that's nothing like a mushroom.
Nah, not at all. No, it's no gills. It's got a very gelatinous texture.
It's like a lump of jelly just stuck on a twig of a tree with lots of lichens on it.
Yep, that's it.
Now, you say you've found 79 species so far. Have you found the death cap, for instance?
No, we were too late for those fungi that are absolutely associated with trees.
Right.
That grow on their roots. I think they're much earlier. A student of mine did a study on Hoth Summit, and he found that those came out a month before the fungi that just live on organic matter.
But this project that's been undertaken here in the Auras, that's going to last for a year.
It is,
That by maybe next, August or so, you will still be researching here. You'll still be looking for different species. You'll probably come across it then.
If it's here, I'll probably come across it.
And finally, you'll be back again throughout the year.
Yes.
Right up to next August or September. Mm. What do you think you'll find then, or what do you hope to find?
Well, what I hope to find in the spring is quite a restricted number of fungi that come up in the spring, and only in the spring, not the autumn. So I'll be looking for them. And then in the summer, I'm going onto the pastures, the cattle graze pasture and the horse graze pasture, because there'll be summer mushrooms coming up on those, not so much in the woodland, though I expect to find fungi in the woodland throughout the year. And then early in the autumn, September, October, we start to get the mycorrhizal, the symbiotic fungi coming up around the trees that have those type of symbiont, because not all trees have mushroom associates.
So if we're looking for the fly agaric, it's come back next August or September.
Yep. And go to birch and possibly one or two of the conifers like pine and spruce.
And you can see some pictures and learn more about this ongoing study on our website, rte.ie/money. That's all we have time for today. Our thanks to our sound engineer, Sheila Neveal, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, our researcher, John Riley, and series producer, Anna Leddy. Until next week, goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented by Derek Mooney. A little added extra for you if you're online tonight or in the coming days. A special programme from a few years back sees Derek visit Errol Fuller's home in England. The house, as we enter it, is filled with hundreds of rare specimens, including stuffed passenger pigeons, platypuses and even hummingbees. Feel free to take a listen back at rte.ie/Mooney to learn more about Fuller's amazing private collection and his fascination with extinct creatures such as the dodo, the great auk and the woolly mammoth.